Accession number 9424, reel 1.
Mr. Cooper, Reel 1. Could you tell me when you were born, Mr. Cooper?
9th of April, 1899, at Wimslow in Cheshire. And then when I was about 2 years old, we moved to Southport in Lancashire. I stayed there till I was about 12. My mother was ill, and we moved into what they called apartments. And then about 1912, yes, we had a house in Southport. Stayed there till 1913. And then we didn't have another house. We just sort of travelled around. We went off to school because my mother had been ill. We went to boarding school in Southport. And then when we came out, we still went into apartments, you know, bedroom, sitting room, and attendance in Southwark until I was called up in April 1917.
What was the occupation of your father?
He was a cotton salesman.
Did he work in the locality?
In Manchester.
Could you tell me how many brothers and sisters you had?
Two brothers.
Were they older than you or younger?
One was 2 years older and one was 1 year older, approximately.
And your own education, you say you went to a boarding school. How long?
Well, first of all, I went to a boys' preparatory school in South. Well, before that, a little very young school, Miss Taylor's. And then we went to a preparatory school in Southport. And then we went to a larger school, boys from about 12 till 18, also in Southport. And I left that school when I was about nearly 17. And then I didn't do anything. I decided to have a year off because I knew in 1918, April, I was going to be called up.
I see.
Which I was.
Did you have any military training at all when you were at school? Did you belong to the OGC?
None at all. None at all.
And you were too young to belong to the territorials?
Yes.
Right. Yes. Can you remember the outbreak of war? Did you actually anticipate that?
Oh, yes, yes. We were in Llangollen in Wales, staying at a house near the River Dee. And, yes, I remember it all boiling up and all these rumours, etc. And my eldest brother, who must have been then about 14, he said, I've got one film left in my camera. He said, I'm going to wait till the Zeppelins come over the Welsh mountains. And then we saw dispatch riders rushing around, etc. And then on the 4th of August, we had... Oh, I know, there was Mrs. Edwards, who was the landlady at the house we were staying in, rather dramatically came in night of the 3rd of August, and with her arms folded, she said, England will be at war with Germany at 12 tonight. And she walked out.
And what was your reaction to that news?
Well, as boys, we weren't very affected. My mother, of course, an aunt who were with us, they were quite depressed by it, but I think we were a bit excited.
Was your father by then too old to be
called? Well, my father wasn't at home from the age of two. He did a walkout.
So
I didn't know about him.
What about your two older brothers? Were they in the... the stage where they might have been called up in 1914?
Oh, no, you see, in 1914, I was 15, the other brother was 16, and the other was 17. So they were getting fairly close. And my elder brother joined what they call the Derby Scheme. That was, you sort of volunteered, and you got an armband with a red crown on it to show that you'd volunteered. And my other brother didn't wait, but he volunteered for the Royal Naval Air Service and got accepted. As I told you, he stayed in Scotland. And I, of course, by the time I was due to go, well, it was just automatic. There was no volunteering. It was just when you became 18, you got your papers and you joined the army.
Because you had two elder brothers who, by the time you were ready to join up, were already in the services, had you any idea of what to expect from the war by that time?
Rather, yes. I used to get when it got closer to the time when my elder brother might go out to France, I used to get quite worried about it and used to dream about him having his brass buttons removed because he was going to France. I used to worry about that, I think, more than I did about myself. Because then the slaughter was great, you know, and although he was in the engineers, he wasn't sort of frontline man. But I used to quite worry about that he'd have to go out to France.
When did it dawn on you, if it did at all, that the war was not going to be over by Christmas or in a comparatively short time?
I think perhaps a year after it started. Then we thought, you know, they had these... The battles and Loos and Lannes, etc., were taken, and these slaughters, and the Ypres we heard about, as though then it would all quieten down, and any advance that took place, I mean, when it came later on, the Battle of Passchendaele, and also when they took Vimy Ridge, etc., well, everybody thought, oh, the newspapers were saying, well, here it comes, your war, it just used to all fizzle out that we got so used to it we began to think it would never end. Remember, one of my confreres in the trenches used to say, oh, well, it'll be all right. He said, oh, what on earth do you see to say? Oh, he said, when the black lights go up, he said, the war's going to end.
Could you describe the process of your call-up? When did you first receive notice that you were going to be?
I received the letter about a month. I can't remember, a month or 3 weeks, that I was to report at the town hall at Southport on the probably about the, in the middle of April. I can't remember the date. In 1917. And I don't know whether you're interested in this, but I had a very kind aunt who, she had her son in the army. He'd lost his arm at Mons already. He was an officer. And she was so, she thought that if I learnt to drive heavy vehicle and car, that I might get in the Royal Army Service Corps and not have to go into the trenches. And she said to my mother, she said, I'll pay for Howard to learn to drive and send him to a school of motoring. So I went to the Blake School of Motoring in Liverpool, had a thorough tuition, mechanical and classes, etc. Drove a Model T Ford, then I drove an overland car, and then I drove a 1 or 2 ton truck all over Liverpool and got my RAC test and everything. Came the day when I reported at the town hall, Southport. There was a sergeant at the desk. He said, yes, next please. I said, Cooper HH, you see, and he looked at it and took me off. And I said, well, I can drive a car and a lorry. And I said, I'd like to join the RASC. He said, we don't want anyone in the RASC. Come on, get on infantry. And that was the end of that.
Okay. So you had signed on or joined up. And what happened to you then? Did you just...
I was sent to Seaforth Barracks, where we spent just 2 nights, and I think there were about 15 of us. And then we were sent by train to Priest Heath and joined the 74th Training Reserve Battalion, all 18ers, except the officers and NCOs.
And could you describe what the Priest Heath barracks was like?
Well, there weren't barracks. It was an extensive camp, all large wooden huts, sleeping about 30 men with a stove in the middle. The outside, of course, outside lavatories and outside washing places with no doors at each end. And in the winter, we used to go out there, and and there were zinc bowls, one cold tap over each place, with icicles on it sometimes, and we used to crack the ice on, and we used to wash in there and dry ourselves, and then go back to the hut where it's fairly warm. And the men that shaved, I didn't shave then, they used to save a mug of tea for the hot water for shaving. But, phew, it was cold, a wind whistling through these great open sheds where we had to wash at 6 o'clock in the morning.
What was your reaction to the army discipline, the army lifestyle?
Oh, I didn't mind it at all. No, I didn't mind the discipline.
Did you feel any sort of loss of privacy or any reaction against that?
No, well, of course, being at boarding school made a difference there. No, I didn't feel a loss of course, the eating was pretty rough, especially at the Priestheath camp when we went, because, when we first arrived at Priestheath, tell me if I'm telling you too much detail. When we arrived at the hut at Priestheath camp, about 15 of us, there were just all these beds, just wooden boards and a mattress of straw, which we had to fill ourselves at the farm. And the sergeant said, "Well, suppose you fellows want some tea?" We said, "Yes." And he said, "Yes, sergeant." You see, pretty good place. And he said, "All right, you and you, go and get tea." And these chaps came with two big buckets full of tea with the milk already in, two loaves of bread, and a great hunk of cheese, and put it on the table. And we all sort of looked a bit. He said, "Well, what the hell are you looking at?" And he said, "When you've been here a couple of weeks," he said, "you won't be looking at cheese and bread like that." He said, "You'll be gnawing the edges off these bloody tables. You'll be so hungry."
Was he right?
Yes. He was so right. We were always hungry with our training. And when they used to, we had stew, you see, in our, I think it was on plates or bowls or something. And then we were still hungry. And then we had rice pudding, and the orderlies that were brought in a great big sort of square tin, you see, and doped out of three ladles full onto our plates. And it was a sort of pale blue colour because there was so little milk in it. And then when there was some left over, we used to say, "Any more?" And we used to chase him with like a mob, chase him all over the beds, taking rice out with our hands onto our plates, if there was any left. And then after that, if we had any money, we used to go to the canteen and have a cake and some bread and butter.
What was the bread like in that time?
It was going a bit dull, greyish, I think, brownish, yes. Because everybody had white bread then, mostly. But we didn't notice that, and we used to have rock cakes. So. But we were healthily hungry, because all the training and physical jerks and everything.
Yes, could you perhaps describe what sort of training you did there at Priestheath?
Yes, we first of all they'd have what they called a rouse parade. We used to get up at 5:30 in the morning, and parade and just march around, and then breakfast, which was tea in bowls. Sometimes we'd have some bacon on them. No plates for breakfast, just a piece of bread with a piece of bacon on it. And then we used to have an hour's physical training and running. Then we'd, for instance, have bayonet drill for half an hour.
Could you describe the bayonet drill that you had?
Yes, well, when we were, say, for instance, went to the first bayonet drill, the sergeant there, well, he was encouraged, of course, you had to have the bloodlust, so the army said. And I remember he'd get the rifle with the bayonet on it, you see, and say, "Now that's your rifle and bayonet. What's the bayonet for?" Then someone would answer, "Oh, to defend yourself with," someone. "Not defend yourself with," he said, "to kill. And he'd sweep the bayonet's scabbard off and throw it on the ground, tap the bayonet with his finger and say, "That's cold steel," he said. "That's what you use to kill. Defend yourself if you like," but he said, "that's a killing instrument." And then, of course, then we had the bayonet drill against stuffed sacks. And we just had to rush towards them and say, ah, ah, stick it in, then out, on guard. And then backwards, slash the bayonet down towards his shoulder, and then reverse the rifle and jab the butt of the rifle into his privates. That was the theory, anyway.
Okay. Did it raise people's bloodlust? If you
no, I don't. I never saw it at all. Mm-hmm. And funnily enough, you know, people would say, did you ever hate... I never heard any of us saying they hated the Germans. It was the people at home that hated them. We used to... I mean, the very fact that we used to call him Jerry indicates there was a sort of... almost a camaraderie. We used to fear him, fear the shells, fear an attack, fear the machine guns, but not hate the individual.
You're talking about the front, your frontline experience now.
Yes.
What was your attitude towards the Germans whilst you were still in training? Had you given it much thought then?
Just afraid of it. And of course we hoped we'd win, and whenever we read in the paper there'd been an attack, well, we were overjoyed or so on, or now they're getting a bit... But individual Germans, I can't remember hating them, and the other Tommies never talked about... The officers used to talk about the bloody Hun, but we didn't. We used to talk about, Jerry's going to give us a bit of a straff tonight, or something like that.
Why do you think there was that difference between what the way the officers described the Germans and the way that you thought of the Germans?
I think it was that the instructions that they had to get up hate among the men.
Could we return to Priest Heath? You were describing your training, and we got as far as the bayonet drill. What other aspects of training were that you underwent?
Long route marches.
What did they consist of?
Oh, perhaps 4 or 5 miles of marching along the country roads, slung rifles and so on, and every perhaps fall out for every half hour for 5 minutes rest. But that, and of course we had gas drills, yes, because then, at that time, they didn't have what they call the box respirator. That hadn't yet been brought out. We had what they called... PH helmets. I don't know what the PH stood for. It was made of flannel with two eyepieces and a mouthpiece, and it had been soaked in glycerine and some other chemical, and you just had to hold it there, put it over your head, tuck the edges around under your tunic, and that was the first gas mask. Which the gas... And then we had...
What would they like to wear?
Oh, all right, because you had a breathing tube, you see, and you could just... Breathe. You could breathe out. Now, what's the breathe in? I think you breathe in through the canvas, yes.
And you breathe out through the tube?
Through the tube. And then we had, when we'd been in several months, we had actual gas drilled in a small hut, and they had cylinders of chlorine gas hissing out. And you walked in with your gas mask, but you realised there was no fear, and you saw all your brass buttons turning green, you see. It was deadly, but you stood into this hut where the chlorine gas was full of, and then you were just let out, and all that. Then you took your mask off.
Were you taught how to recognise gas by...
By the smell, yes. You smell chlorine gas. And then, of course, they had... later on, they had a phosgene gas which smelt of pear drops, if you ever know what pear drops are. That smell. And, of course, you had, if you felt... If the wind was blowing towards you, that was the time when gas could be expected. You would never gas attack if the wind was flowing from behind you. And what we used to do, suddenly you felt a faint, if you thought it was going to wet your finger and hold it up, you see, and of course this end went cold first, you knew which direction the wind was coming from. And then, of course, later the box respirator came out, very much like in the Second War, with a rubber mask and tube, and etc. And we went through the same same drills with that.
That was why Stuart Preece Heath, wasn't it?
Preece Heath and Oswestry, who still has gas drills.
Were you given instructions about things like wind direction and when to expect gas attacks while
yes,
you were there?
Yes. Then, of course, there was gas shelling, of course. Well, I don't know. We never seemed to have much. We used to have gas shelling, but it was mostly seemed to be a lot of tear gas that just made your ears run and eyes running. But directly, if there was any gas, you just flip. There's a drill, of course, how to put the gas mask on.
Could you describe that drill? Could you describe that drill?
Yes. You wore the gas mask. I'm speaking now of the box respirator one. You had it so that the gas mask came out at the front. You put your hand in like that. Put your hands into the gas mask, underneath and over with the elastic straps, and then fix the mouthpiece in. That was all, and we were taught. Of course, we'd have a parade, and quite unexpectedly, well, they'd shout out gas, and then you'd oh, like that, you see, quickly.
Could you describe your training with the rifle?
Well, first of all, we had to. The training of the rifle was more or less ceremonial. You had to slope arms, order arms, present arms, and so on and so, which, were, of course, weren't used in battle, but were used on various parades, and to get you used to handling the rifle, I suppose.
Once you'd mastered that, what did you have to do next?
Well, then, of course, you had to learn how to load the rifle. Put on the safety catch, put off the safety catch, and also without any cartridges in, you had to, for instance, say, right, load your rifle, then you had to get in your pack, press the magazine in, put it at the top, shove the bolt in, then put release the safety catch, and then say 5 rounds rapid fire. Then you go down in your stomach, and there'd just be five clicks, you see, as you. But when we went later, and I say fired the course, then it was live ammunition. But as regards rifle drill, well, that was just parade drill, really, which there was an awful lot of.
Did you actually go to firing ranges to learn how to fire the rifle in earnest?
Oh, yes.
Could you describe what happened in that situation?
Well, in that situation, you went lay down in on the ground, usually, and then you were just told so many rounds, and then targets would appear up in the shape of men, and then they'd say five rounds rapid fire, and you'd fire that. Targets would go down. Sometimes you'd have moving targets that you had to fire. And of course, when you were firing, you had to set the range on your rifle. There's a little calibrated thing that you put 100 yards, 200 yards, which you had to put first of all because of the trajectory of the bullet. Of course, if it was a long distance, well, the bullet didn't go straight for the target. Of course, it went more or less over on the trajectory, which was compensated for by this little scale. Yes.
I see. And did you get any sort of results back from your?
Oh yes. Well, when it was not fire, rapid fire. They said 1 round fire. Well, if there were then targets like dartboards, about 100 yards away or so, and there were men behind those in a trench. You see, it's on top of a big bank. Well, they used to wave an indicator as to whether you got a bullseye on outer or on inner.
How did you fare at rifle?
I got a first class shot when I fired my course, as they call it.
What is a first class shot in army terms?
It's just a certain score. It's so long ago, I can't remember what the score had to be.
Was there any grades above that?
Marksman, yes. And second class shot too, and third class shot.
Could you describe what other things you had to do with the rifle, like, for example, cleaning drill and things like that?
Yes. After you had fired the rifle, this did not happen in the trenches. But I know when we fired our rifle at ranges, they had to have boiling water. You open it, we poured boiling water down, because that opened the pores of the rifling, you see. And then you had a thing with sort of wire gauze on at the end of it. You put one end down, pull that wire gauze right through the rifle a few times, and then an oily rag soaked in oil, you drew that through so as to oil the barrel, and the barrel was beautifully, and you looked through it and you saw it glistening right at the top.
And these were checked.
And everyone was, of course, that you had to keep your rifle in. It was a crime to have a dirty rifle.
Okay. Could you say if there were any tactical exercises that you took part in at Prees Heath?
Well, honestly, I can't remember doing any tactical exercises of sham attacks or night operations. If I did, it's gone out of my memory.
Were you actually issued with your rifle there, or was it one that you sort of were issued for the day and then?
Oh, just for the day and back. We didn't get issued with our own rifle until a few days we went out to the front.
What kit were you issued with at Prees Heath?
Well, of course, uniform, pack, equipment, bayonet sling, mess tin, entrenching tool handle. We had steel hats sort of in and out practice. That's the lot.
And presumably boots as well.
Oh, of course, boots, yes. And rather an unusual thing these days, we had thick, lovely thick woolen undervests with long sleeves and thick woolen long johns. And we kept those on winter and summer. And we used to go for 10-mile route marches in them.
I see. That must have been very uncomfortable, I suppose.
No. I don't know. I think of it now. I think it was... No, it wasn't. We always had these thick wool things on. And, of course, putties round our legs as well.
Were you taught how to put those on, the putties? Was there?
Oh, at first, yes. And you had to have them put on tidily, you know. You didn't get told off all the rolls had to be evenly apart, you see. You couldn't have one that wide and then one that wide.
Well, it's one very wide and one narrow.
No, they all had to be even.
Did they take long to put on?
Oh, no. They were 2 minutes each leg.
Could you tell me about inspections? Presumably there were quite regular inspections.
Well, there was a kit inspection in the huts. Speaking now of Prees Heath ends, in the huts there was a kit inspection, and that was very exact. You had to have your blankets folded up exactly on top of the bed, which was just three boards, and you had to have the towel rolled up and the soap, and then I can still remember you had to have knife, fork, spoon, razor, comb, scrubbing brush, toothbrush, soldier's friend for polishing, and they all had to be in an exact pattern, so that when the inspection came, the officer could tell to look by the pattern that everything was there.
What happened if everything was not in its place?
Well, he'd just speak to the sergeant and say, that man's kit isn't laid out properly, you see, and you'd just get told off. But no, not a crime.
Did that ever happen to you?
No. I was always very tidy. Still am, as a matter of fact.